This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's first check in with Meredith Colius-Pete with the Post-Tribune about the stories that she's put out. A lot of them we have to talk about today are related to education, in particular to some of the Northwest Indiana schools. Meredith, thanks for joining us again today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, let's first, we'll get together and talk here a little bit along with you and your colleague, Carol Carlson, who worked together on the single story earlier about the reaction by students and the like but concerning the request of gun reform and some of the other topics that they brought up in relationship to the Florida mass shooting. But first, let's talk a little bit here about what the Meritville High School students had asked for in a creation of a forum that is addressing the question of school safety.
Yeah, absolutely. The forum at Meritville High School on Tuesday was very interesting. Essentially, what it was is that you had like the principal and superintendent, head of security, the school police officer, and the police chief in Meritville. They sort of came together for a sort of a Q&A with students to really kind of talk about, safety issues and, what they can do to reach out to students who may seem isolated.
I know that there was, some discussion about various topics and all about how this was, was this forum created? Was it simply just in response to all the questions that came about as a result of, at least most lately, the Florida mass shootings?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely it. Obviously this week you've seen, thousands of students across the country sort of walk out and looking for changes in gun laws. At Meritville, schools sort of had to green light this for students to be able to do that. At Meritville, the thought was that they would have this panel to bring the issue out in the open with students and answer their questions. And also, they kind of looked at it as a way to sort of kind of do this instead of having students walk out at that particular high school. The following day on Wednesday, the school put out a school survey for students just to kind of get their feedback. And they also did some activities inside the school rather than having students walk out. What I observed in the panel itself went on for about 3 hours. And it had, about 100 students or so from freshmen to seniors. And so it was a pretty good cross-section of students. And, what you heard were some very good questions from a lot of these students. And a lot of them expressed some real fears for their safety. And they asked questions with really going into detail of, what they would expect, what's the best thing to do in the case that the school would ever have to deal with mass shooting, how many police officers would be available, how a lockdown would be announced and how they would be formed and kind of things of that nature, just to kind of give them as much information as possible.
I understand they had some opportunity for students to talk with even some of the school board members. They came to the forum, and I imagine I know a couple in particular rather pointed questions. I think that some students asked about guns, and in particular about teachers carrying guns.
Right, and it's only natural for them to ask, in the midst of this debate that you really see going on across the country right now, what happens, what is the school considering in terms of safety after the most recent school mass shooting that you saw in Florida last month? Some questions that did come up included whether or not the school was going to consider metal detectors, or of course the debate that's going on about Army teachers right now. Tom Bainbridge was the school board member that was there, and of course he kind of started off his remarks by telling students that he himself, was an activist and went out and protested civil rights there in Vietnam and things of that nature. And of course he said he couldn't say for certain, but basically his feeling is that, things like metal detectors and Army teachers were things that Meritville was not going to consider.
Yeah.
What they do, of course, is, look at ways to reach kids who, that they say that maybe having a hard day or just isolated, or doing things that are preventative rather than you wait till the point that a student could be a real safety issue, and that's kind of the things that we're talking about.
I understand that Meritville High School Principal Mike Krutz talked about some concerns, that he has received from parents. What seemed to be the biggest concern that the principal of the school learned from parents?
you know, he says unequivocally that in his day-to-day role as a principal, the number one concern that he puts from parents is bullying. And that's something that you would expect, and you see it in many other schools. Mm-hmm. And so that's really something that they look at. Is, you know, bullying is definitely a tough thing for, as it has been. It's kind of a tough thing for school administrators to identify and control, naturally.
Now, what kind of impression did you get after the forum finished up at Maryville High School as to whether that high school may be perhaps different from others in the region, might be better prepared or need to prepare better for any problems that they could result as a result of these issues they brought up?
Sure. And many of these things that were talked were purely informational, and it's kind of important to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that the school did point out to students, it was both a concern that administrators had and that the students brought directly in the forum a few times, is that Maryville has about, nearly a dozen doors that are open each morning when kids are going into class. And naturally, you would think about that, and they expressed some concerns that that's a safety risk to them. And Maryville came back to them and said that was something that they were thinking about, and that would be a definite change that they would make after the Florida shooting, is that they were looking to cut down the number of open entrances, for example.
Okay. We'll come back to this topic in just a moment here, but we're talking with Meredith Colias-Pete with the Post Tribune about the stories that she's had online here on Regionally Speaking today. One other story I know that you had this week related to education deals with parochial education, and you had some information, I guess it was very interesting, about how the use of parochial schools and vouchers seem to fit together here within Lake and Porter counties, and this is information that you got from the Diocese of Gary, I understand. Fill us in about that, please.
Sure, absolutely. About a week ago or so, the Department of Education in Indiana released a report on school vouchers. A lot of it, was where kids lived and what public school district they lived in, and if they used a voucher, where did they end up going to school? And what we found, sort of crunching the numbers, is that the Diocese of Gary, by far was the biggest beneficiary of school vouchers in Northwest Indiana. We looked specifically at Lake and Porter County. Overall, of course, the diocese also has schools in Michigan City. Their head of schools has kind of told us that about 38% or so of their students use vouchers, and it adds up to about $10 million per year that they receive from the program. So it's a pretty big amount of money.
Well, wow. I understand that I guess quite a bit of the money had come into the Gary Diocese in Lake and Porter counties. And it was a big beneficiary to what the diocese actually needs to run the school system.
Right, absolutely. And you're looking at, if you look at a school by school breakdown, certainly Bishop Knoll in particular is sort of the biggest, beneficiary in the diocese. They mm-hmm. they get about $1.6 million per year in money through the program, and it's about 25% of their students, according to the state, that use money. And you're also looking at St. Casimir, which is a school that the diocese runs, I believe, in Hammond, if I'm not mistaken. Over 80% of their students use vouchers. So what you're seeing in specific schools is that the voucher program is, arguably really helping these schools sort of keep up their enrollment.
Yeah. I also know, too, that the story, based on the report, talks about not only did the Diocese of Gary do very well in receiving vouchers and the like, the Roman Catholic school systems weren't the only ones that received a lot from the state to be able to get the students taken care of. Ambassador Christian Academy was another one. Tell us what you learned in that in your research.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an important example. It's not just Catholic schools that are receiving money under the voucher program. Of course, in Northwest Indiana, you have a whole range of schools from, non-affiliated Christian schools to you have a school dedicated to Islamic studies, for example. Ambassador Academy is a school in particular that stands out because it is located within Gary, and it has maybe about 150 students or so. The vast majority come from the boundaries of the Gary Community School Corporation, and nearly all their students receive vouchers, certainly, and they received about $1 million in total this year under the program. They recently went before the State Board of Education, which is important to note because they have received the past two years or so, D grades, and under the original kind of rules for voucher schools, that would have meant that that sort of record would have meant that they could have been suspended from the voucher program and, not allowed to receive new students until their accountability grade increased. They recently, however, went down to the State Board of Education. There was a law that was passed in about 2016 or so that gave schools the right to request a waiver from suspension under those circumstances, and they were successful in getting a waiver. So for the time being, they will still be allowed to receive new students using vouchers.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to the topic of activism in schools and the like, as a result, in particular, of course, been other issues in the past, but in particular, the latest one being the Parkland, Florida mass shooting at the school there. I know you and your colleague, Carol Carlson, worked together on trying to cover some of the events in the last 48 hours, and a lot of work that was done that ended up in the stories that you and Carol had managed to share bylines on. Give us, if you will, your take on the people you talked to, the places you went during the day yesterday, Friday, Wednesday.
Sure, absolutely. I myself was in Chesterton at the high school yesterday. I believe that Carol was out at Hobart, I believe, yesterday. And so we had already been sort of in touch with various schools along the way. So we kind of were keeping in touch with them as well during the day. Certainly it's sort of been all over the news. You've seen, Northwest Indiana's students across the area, joined thousands and thousands of kids across the country. I've seen kind of one estimate that maybe 2,500 to 3,000 students participated in the national walkout yesterday. And for, folks that may not have been keeping up on this certainly it was marking the 1 month anniversary of the Parkland, Florida shooting that you saw on Valentine's Day. This particular walkout, it was sort of an outgrowth of the Women's March that happened last year. You had a lot of organizers, and indeed in this area, some organizers sort of, reaching out to students and sort of encouraging them to sort of step up and, sort of organize walkouts in their individual schools. Some of the, we've talked to quite a few student leaders, and these are select students. It is important to point that out. We talked to student leaders across schools in every school, in particular, that we could in Northwest Indiana, and some common threads that we're finding from a lot of these students is that many of them, were already, politically active. They sort of grown up with them. A lot of parents have taken them to, political rallies and marches and things of that nature. The Women's March is something that did come up over and over again. A lot of these students had gone to with their parents, and the most important thing that really came, from almost every student that we asked is that they have been watching these Parkland students very, very closely. Of course, this generation is very in tune. They have so much information just at their fingertips on the internet, social media. They've been watching these students who have been, using Twitter and in particular sort of as a platform for them to speak out and sort of advocate for what they feel that they are want changes in gun laws. The CNN town hall that aired recently came up a lot, where you see they look at a lot of these students that are going and very much using this sort of public platform to advocate for things that they feel that they want to change in this country. And so you see a lot of these students locally sort of describing this as an elected moment almost for them that are interested in this kind of thing, that they felt like seeing someone that their peers that they could identify with sort of really resonated with them themselves, and they felt like this was a moment for them to sort of step up and try to lead these walkouts at their schools.
Merida, thank you very much for spending time explaining in detail here, and we're going to get another take as well shortly from your colleague Carol Carlson about what happened during the day at the schools here in Northwest Indiana in particular. But it sounds like that's the common thread, that it's some very active students, very concerned students, and this is certainly not going to end with just one particular day of walking out of class, to be sure.
Yeah, and that remains to be seen, very briefly. Of course, there's two sides to the story as well. And so it's definitely not every student, that sort of aspires to this point of view. We're sort of keeping our eye on a couple of things coming up as well. March 24th is sort of another day of marches that are expected, including the March for Life that Parkland students are organizing in D.C. And here locally, there's expected to be, a march in Highland at Mayfair Park. There's going to be one in East Chicago that we're watching closely at Unity Plaza. There's another big one in Chicago. And then April 20th as well is the anniversary of the Columbine shooting. We're kind of keeping our eye on Porter County, because what we're hearing from several students is that They're trying to get multiple students together, and it looks like it's happening from various high schools like Bellflower, Chesterton, Crown Point, Portage, possibly Couts together for a protest that may end up at the Porter County Courthouse. So that's what we're kind of looking at as well.
Well, Meredith, sounds like it was a great effort for everybody involved in this, and we appreciate you spending time talking about your side of the story, that so to speak, that you had covered for the Post-Tribune yesterday. We've been talking with Meredith Colius-Pete with the Post-Tribune, and we'll chat with you again soon, I hope.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn to Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune to look further into the story that she and Meredith had worked on involving Wednesday's walkouts from the schools around Northwest Indiana in protest of concerns about guns and school violence. Carol, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Well, let's pick up here. You had covered a number of the school districts in Northwest Indiana, as Meredith covered some in Porter County. Tell us about what you discovered first at Hobart.
At Hobart, they had a real good crowd, about 300 kids. Kind of hard to count that assemblage, but it went orderly and peacefully, and the students worked with the administrators to plan the event.
That was one of the things I noticed that, and you put it in the story about the fact that Superintendent Peggy Buffington and her staff almost bent over backwards to make sure that the students could actually take something home, so to speak, from what they learned by just going out and offering their views on these things.
Yeah, I think that was very insightful on the part of Hobart administrators. She told me afterwards that they wanted to make sure that this just wasn't another event, so they came out and said a few words and then, you know, went back to class. She said she wanted there to be some effect from what they were doing, and for it not to just be another event, but for something for them to actually think about putting their words into some kind of action, whatever that could be.
Mm-hmm. I know, too, that in your story, that you and Meredith had looked into how the response was going to be from the school districts across Northwest Indiana, and I understand that not all of the school districts sanctioned any kind of walkout action at all, or even any activity, and in particular, some school districts here in Lake County were sort of that way. Did you find out why?
There were a lot of mixed results on these walkouts. In Crown Point, for example, and we don't know why, because they never called us back, but the administration there did not want the students to go outside. They did allow them to assemble in the gym and have a program in the gym, and they went so far as to block parents and citizens and the media from attending.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, and I'm not sure it's related, I doubt very much if there's a relationship here, but we know that there had been some Facebook threats and some other threats on social media coming into the school districts in Northwest Indiana in some locations, and we know that Crown Point was one of those locations. But I note that you mentioned in particular the school town of Highland didn't participate in this. Was it, what you can tell, basically the same reason? They just decided that they wanted to opt to have something in-house, so to speak?
Yeah, I think that there is that specter of uncertainty that's out there when you have such an assemblage that you don't have control over, and some administrators were reluctant to let this go and turn into a walkout. I know in Valparaiso, students who walked out were given detention, which seems to be a harsh penalty.
I noticed that their photos, you can see them, of course, online and in the newspaper, too. The ones you took from Hobart, of the students out there standing around the flagpole at the front of the building and doing their part to make their views known about this. One other story I know you covered separately on topic of school safety and guns issues deals with the question about arming teachers, whether it's really a very good idea. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, this came up because I had heard about this group down at Purdue called the Purdue Institute of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
It's headed up by its director, is Indiana's first director of Homeland Security. His name is Eric Dietz. And he supervised some graduate students in creating a model. They created four computer models, actually, and it followed the Sandy Hook shootings. And they gave these models four different scenarios, and they ran them through a active shooter situation and came out with different results.
That's interesting. What did they tell you in the report as to what they found, whether it was wise to give teachers guns, so to speak, or let them carry guns into the classroom?
Well, they didn't really get into the politics of the debate.
Yeah.
They said they tried to keep that out of it. But what they determined, and it's only common sense, really, that the more you can do to slow down an active shooter situation, the probably more lives are going to be saved, more injuries won't occur. And their first scenario was, you know, if there is no school police officer on the scene and nobody's there, there will be casualties, and probably a large amount. Mm-hmm. And finally, the last scenario was if there is a school resource officer who's a police officer, as well as armed school personnel, which could be a teacher, could be a administrator, the response, they said, was slowed dramatically. The director called it a profound difference.
Wow.
He said that, felt that more lives could be saved. Yeah, more people there.
Sounds like it was a very interesting report, and I'm sure that you'll probably have an opportunity to check back with these folks, and maybe we'll have another story that'll come forth on this sometime in the future. And staying with the school topic, in this case we're talking about going down to the Gary Community School Corporation, and you covered a story about involved the award-winning Banneker Achievement Center and how it may be converted into a different kind of school. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Banneker is on a new route now because the building, anyway, is going to become the Gary's citywide middle school for all the kids. The current Banneker Achievement Center the kids are going to be moved, K-5 kids, into Marquette Elementary. And that's going to happen next fall.
Mm-hmm. What kind of reaction have you noted from parents and people who are involved with the school very closely as to whether they think that's a good idea or not?
Yeah, there was a meeting last week with the Banneker parents, and as you might expect, the reaction was mixed. Some of the parents understood the need for this change. There was a parent survey, and the location of the middle school was presented to be Bailey out in Glen Park, and mm-hmm. parents who took that survey did not like that idea. So the emergency manager came up with the idea of Banneker, which formerly was a middle school, and that sort of came together as the favored spot. So the elementary kids are going to have to be displaced, and that possibility of some disruption, you know, has parents on alert, and they voice their concerns.
I know that you mentioned that came forth in the meeting that Dr. Hinckley was rather emphatic about the fact that Banneker is really a good building to be able to put middle school in, that it had been, and it is not the first time that this idea has been thought of. So.
Yeah, there was some reluctance on parents.
Yeah.
And to be clear, Banneker is a magnet school for gifted children, and it has been for probably two decades or maybe more, I'm not sure. And so you have to be tested to get into Banneker, for one thing, and the students tend to be focused and very studious. And some of the parents were a little reluctant about their children coming into a population with other, you know, more traditional, I guess you'd say, school students that might not share the same focus, might consider the Banneker gifted children as nerds and bullying, and they presented several different scenarios. And emergency manager Hinckley, you know, said that, you know, your kids are going to be exposed to all different sorts of people at some point in their life, and all the kids in Gary are good kids, and, you know, this won't be the worst thing that's ever happened.
Well, we'll see how this all turns out, to be sure here. Finally, Carol, let's talk about one other story that you covered for the Post-Tribune. It deals with the Gary-Chicago International Airport. We've seen a lot of construction work out there at the airport in the last few years. That's aside from all the work that was done to the runways, and now there's another big project, I understand, that's going to start up out there before long.
Yeah, they decided to build a new hangar. It's going to be a corporate hangar. We did not find out who was going to be using this hangar. I don't know if that means they're still in negotiations with this company.
Yeah.
or what that means, but it's going to be on the far east side of the airport, and they're saying that it should be ready to go by October.
Wow. Well, you know, I remember going out to the airport at one point, and they were still working on the latest big hangar to go up out there in the same area as the Gary Jet Center. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. Also, too, I understand that there was an update that was recently mentioned, too, on how this this U.S. Customs and Border Patrol facility is that's going to be out there at the airport is coming along. What was the latest that you learned at the meeting?
They're renovating a former safety training building to serve as the Customs and Border Patrol facility. And so they're doing a lot of construction. And all of that work is on schedule, and they are preparing for probably a late June opening.
Wow, that's good. I know they've been working on
that. That will allow passengers who deplane in Gary who need to clear customs to do so right in Gary.
Yeah, I talked with some people that had mentioned the fact that they didn't necessarily appreciate having to go all the way either into Chicago to one of the airports or even the other way over to South Bend to be able to check in customs just to be able to do that. It's going to be very, very convenient.
As far as Detroit,
Yeah, that's true. Very, very convenient for folks that want to come in directly into Northwest Indiana, to be sure. We've been talking with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune about the stories that she and some of her colleagues have worked on for the newspaper recently. And thank you for taking time to talk with us about it here on the program.
Thank you, Chris.
Talk to you again soon. Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, let's check in with Carrie Napoleon with the Post Tribune about stories that she's worked on for the newspaper in print as well as online. Carrie, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. How are you today, Chris?
I'm fine, thank you. Here, let's start in first with the latest that you've learned about the new Crown Point City Building, in particular what Mayor David Uran is going to consider as his new office complex.
Well, they are getting ready to begin demolition. It should start relatively soon. They purchased the property on the corner of Indiana 55 and North Street.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And it is the old Lake County Greenhouse. They're going to tear that all down. They do have some folks that want to take some of that equipment out of there. Some not-for-profit greenhouse down in southern Indiana is going to come and salvage what they can, and then it's going to be gone. And hopefully within a year and a half or so, 2 years, they will have their new building.
Well, that's great. Well, I've been past there enough times in the years past, and it's not a very pleasant building to look at, especially if you have to stop at the traffic light there and wait for the traffic to go by. And there's nothing to look at except this dilapidated greenhouse complex, and it's really sad. This is definitely going to be a good urban renewal project, to be sure.
Well, definitely, and especially leading into the sportsplex, which is right behind it. Now, the two properties abut each other, so that's going to be a nice entrance into what is really a gem in the city.
Well, I wonder, too, since we know that this is basically plans for City Hall as well as the public safety complex, that is the police department, which sorely needs additional space, and probably they'll want to relocate some fire department trucks out there if they haven't already or plan to do so. There's going to be a lot that's going to come about in that particular area. Give us some background, if you will, please, on what you learned about in the work that was done in once the city got hold of this site. How much did it cost to buy this and all the other work that's going to be involved in this project?
Well, you know, they did get a really good deal from the Fetters family on the property. They ended up paying $750,000 for it, and it was appraised at almost double that. So, you know, they did get a good deal on the property. And they do, as I understand, their plans right now are not to move any of the fire department.
Okay, so it is strictly going to be police
leaving.
And food city hall. Yeah.
Yeah, with the police leaving, that'll free up some space for the fire department in that building, and they are looking at another fire location, but it would not be in that area. It would be a little further.
I suppose that even once City Hall moves out, there may be a possibility for some expansion into the buildings there that they'll take its place. I would think they can take advantage of that space too. Give us a little more information here about what you learned about what this building is likely to look like.
It's going to have. They're looking to have a nice community center in there, a room like a meeting area room. A bigger city council chambers, because currently, with the issues that came up most recently with the gas station, which I think we're going to talk about, people were lined up down the stairs. The chamber is really really way too small for their needs. It's going to be a very nice looking building. That's they have some artist renderings out already, and hopefully things will kind of move forward quickly for them.
Let's also follow through with what you mentioned here there in Crown Point, what the city council seemed to have to take up here after reviewing what the Board of Zoning Appeals had to say about a change in zoning for a gas station.
Correct. They were looking, and this is not the first time a gas station has been proposed for that corner of 125th and 9 Mile, right by Crown Point High School. It's the entrance into the street that leads to Crown Point High School.
Yeah.
And a number of gas stations, this is the third time a gas station has tried to locate there. The first one didn't go through with it. They withdrew their petition because the residents really kind of came out in force. And they did so again the second time, and that one actually went through the process and was voted down by both the BCA and the city council, and then again this third time with Family Express. Now, a convenience store can go there. They don't need special approval. They could break ground in a convenience store tomorrow,
yeah,
and the residents wouldn't know, but they cannot put a gas station there without a special use permit. Yeah.
Do you get the impression that apparently that would be more to the liking of the residents out there to have some type of a facility out there, something like a 7-Eleven or whatever?
Oh, no. No. The residents are highly opposed to the convenience store kind of aspect of it. I think they are a little more hopeful for an office building or like a dentist's office or some kind of professional type building as opposed to any kind of convenience store, anything that would potentially have to be well-lit, cause students to come and loiter, or perhaps, one of the concerns with students would maybe try and ditch class, come and grab a snack, things of that nature. I don't know how founded those concerns are, but that's what some of the residents expressed.
We're talking with Carrie Napoleon of the Post Tribune about the stories that she's had online as well as in print in the newspaper here recently. And Carrie, I'd like for you to be able to go into more detail and talk about this. You spent a lot of time in South Lake County and in nearby Newton and Porter counties during the time that the Kankakee River flooding took place. And you put out a great article that ended up online as well as in print to talk about the impact of how the flooding would be in that particular area on the residents that live down there. And they must be rather brave and hardy people, the people that live down there in places like Shelby and Snyder and the other communities down there, so close to what turns out to be a rather often flood situation for them, I would imagine. Tell us a little bit, if you will, about Bill Voiles. He's a very interesting fellow, and you certainly spent time in your article, put time in your article that showed up talking about him and his particular problems.
Yes, Wild Bill is a very interesting character. He was a wonderful man just to have an opportunity to get to know. But his problems are definitely significant. Mm-hmm. The flooding, he was not able to. Some of the homes are a little higher up. Some were able to get sandbags to prevent anything from getting to them, the water from getting to the actual home. His home sat a little lower, and he just did not get sandbags around it in time. And he had about 12 to 18 inches of water in his house. I visited, it was drained, but yeah, it had already damaged the house. It's in bad shape.
In going through the neighborhood, did you notice a lot of homes down there that were maybe like Bill's, that were so close to the level of the river to begin with, and so they were prone to be flooded into easily?
Oh, definitely. Everything, you have to think the river was originally an Everglade.
Yeah.
So that it's just kind of reclaiming itself when the water comes. And this was a historic flood. It has never been this high. The last time on the Porter Jasper County side, it was this high, was in 1982. On the Lake County side, it was 2013, I believe, that it was perhaps this high again. They were a little more prepared on the Lake County side, a lot more sandbags at the ready. They still had significant damage to some of the homes out there. But it was not, the water was not as deep as it was on the Jasper Porter County side.
Right.
It was very bad out there. I've done this for a very long time, and I have never seen anything locally that devastating.
I know
these people are still underwater, too.
I know you spent a lot of time in Porter County and had a chance to spend time talking with County Commissioner Laura Blaney, which is in her district down there. What were some of the things that she mentioned to you that you're able to put in your story that kind of explained the situation for the residents in Porter County along the river?
Well, there's only, you know, just so many places where the water can go. The county has been out there daily. They're using a drone that they purchased that has come in handy for this. It wasn't purchased for this reason, but they've been able to fly up and down the banks of the river on both sides and just ensure, because it's been so saturated for so long, that no new breaches are occurring. It's going to take a couple more weeks for the river to drop below flood stage again, and that's if we don't get any more rain.
Yeah.
So there's still that whole question of what may happen if rain comes. Some of the roads are washed out. Some of the bridges in Porter County on the Porter County side have been washed out. Once water clears, Public Works is really going to have some work to do to get things back up to where they need to be.
In talking with the folks in Lake and Porter counties, and we know that now that Governor Holcomb has issued the emergency declarations for both, for actually all three, for Lake, Porter, and Newton County, and Jasper counties too now, and there, this gives the residents out there an opportunity to get some help from the state, I would imagine. What has been done out there to help the residents, or as far as the state services are concerned, to get them back towards normal?
Well, in both Lake and Jasper counties, the state did set up an emergency disaster response site for residents from anywhere that was affected by the flooding could come and get assistance. The Red Cross was there. Every government agency that you would have needed to deal with was there. You could get documents, like if your birth certificate, if your driver's license, something like that was damaged in the flood and you didn't have it, they were ready to provide that to you on the spot, as well as food stamps. Hotels for the people that had no place to stay. There were a lot of immediate needs that they set up and tried to connect residents with. Now, as I understand it, they are no longer operating those centers, but residents still have access to the information and can still file claims. There's a website that they can go to and file their claim, and they encourage anybody who has water damage from the floods to do so. The more people who file a complaint, it shows just the level of damage and helps increase possibilities for federal aid as well as state aid.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, we know that there have been meetings. People have talked to local officials to get some additional help, and we've gotten now the state assistance out there, too. With all of this assistance that's come in, have you had a chance to get any impression from the folks that live in the affected areas, whether they're going to leave the area, move out to drier, higher land, or they're going to stay put?
Now, the folks who live along the river, they are some very special people. They understand the dangers and the challenges of the homes that they chose. A lot of these folks, I mean, they're coming together to work with one another. Some have pumps, and they were going from house to house to help people get the water out of their yard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real sense of community. I don't get a feeling that many of them, if any of them, will actually try and relocate. They may try to be more prepared for the next time around, but to actually relocate, I really don't get the feeling. They love being there, and in the summer when it's nice, it's a beautiful place to be. Do you give up the chance that this happens for the enjoyment, for all the years of enjoyment that you can have otherwise? That's what they were telling me.
Uh-huh.
Like, yeah, we know we could flood, but everything else is so wonderful out there.
People like Wild Bill Voiles is definitely one of those who's going to stay regardless of what happens down there.
Oh, most definitely.
Yes,
most
that's
definitely.
Nice to hear. We've been checking into with the situation with the flooding along the Kankakee River and some other stories from Carrie Napoleon from the Post Tribune, who's worked on these, in particular a very in-depth story about the situation with the flooding along the Kankakee River. And we really, really appreciate you spending time and putting out such a great story that showed up online and in print about this, Carrie. And we hope to have you back again. Talk soon.
Well, thank you so much. You have a great day.
Many lawmakers referred to the 2018 legislative session as a weird one, and Senate President Pro Tem David Long summed up its final moments as chaotic. That same senator also had a surprising announcement about halfway through. Indiana Public Broadcasting's State House reporter Brandon Smith offers this look at the General Assembly's 2018 session and how it most likely won't and will be remembered.
About 3 weeks before it began, House Speaker Brian Bosma was already saying this session would be different.
There's usually one overarching, bright, shiny object that keeps attention focused, and it's a little bit different this year.
past shiny objects dominated discussion throughout sessions, including road funding and right to work. But many of this session's issues came and went like a flash in the pan. One of them was a high priority for Democrats, the annual and so far futile effort to pass a hate crimes bill. Senator Greg Taylor has led that effort for a decade. He says his faith was shaken by this session's failure.
My heart can't do it anymore. My soul can't do it anymore.
On the House side, a Republican caucus priority couldn't even get a vote on the floor. Township government reform, which would have required about 300 small townships statewide to consolidate, sailed through House committees, but Republican Representative Cindy Zimke's measure stalled on the final day of the session's first half.
I didn't have the support of the caucus, so I wasn't going to call it down and have it voted down.
And while lawmakers worked to find common ground on many other issues, Senate President Pro Tem David Long announced he'll retire later this year, not halfway through his term.
I want everyone to know that I'm doing this for the right reasons, because for me it's time, and for no other reason.
Long is a 22-year legislative veteran who spent 12 years leading the Senate. Still, the legislature moved on, and some key issues found resolution. Lawmakers legalized cannabidiol, or CBD oil. They approved legislation to adjust Indiana's workforce development system and a measure to fill a funding gap for K-12 public schools. And a bill cleared both chambers to ensure recipients of the federal immigration program DACA can get professional licenses from the state. But even lawmakers called the session's end chaotic. State law set its deadline at midnight, yet with a few bills still unsettled, tax legislation, school safety, a Muncie-Gary school takeover bill, and autonomous vehicle regulations, lawmakers pushed things to the limit. The governor sought to extend the deadline by an hour, but legislative leaders questioned that move's legality.
As for the Senate, I think we should wrap up our business.
The House followed soon after.
All right. Well, it's finally over.
And so the session ended. Still, after all that, 2018 will likely be remembered most for this.
I respectfully ask for members to vote yes in favor of this in making history in Indiana, allowing Sunday sales.
For the first time in Indiana's 201-plus years as a state, Hoosiers can buy alcohol at the store on Sunday. And for some lawmakers, including House Democratic leader Terry Gooden, that achievement reigned over all in 2018. He says it's not something to be proud of.
This session seems like a Twinkie. It fills you up, but there's just nothing of real substance or value to it.
For those lawmakers, it's wait till next year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and many thanks to the reporters from the Post-Tribune who joined us for Reporters Roundtable Thursday, Meredith Colius-Pete, Carol Carlson, and Carrie Napoleon. Next week, we'll bring you a conversation about the 2018 Valparaiso University Jazz Festival. We hope you'll join us for Regionally Speaking next week.